From the World Newsroom in Boston, I'm Patrick Cox, and this is The World in Words number 5. So you want to learn a foreign language. Why? It seems as though everyone speaks English these days. Well, there are some people who insist on mastering foreign tongues. Now, they might just get government help. Also today, language sensitivities and Euro-trashy music.
As a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Si se puede, is right. Yes, we can.
There are no knowns. There are things we know that we know.
Thank you, Borat. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. You can find out more about the show, including how to subscribe to all of our podcasts, by going to theworld.org. Let's face it, if you are a native English speaker, there's so little incentive to learn another language. One day there may be no incentive at all. English is becoming more dominant across the globe every year. Every day. Then there are those millions of non-English speakers who are learning English. Now, they usually do that for economic reasons. But another consequence of that is that when you or I go on vacation to Mexico or Thailand or Poland, yes, some people do go on vacation to Poland. If you go to any of these places, you'll find many people who can speak to you in English. What's not to like? Well, today we're going to hear from some Americans who, in spite of all of this, are learning foreign languages. In a few minutes, we have an interview with a language addict. First, though, we consider one particular foreign language that very, very few English speakers understand. But it's a language that the Bush administration is pushing for more people to learn for national security reasons. That language, of course, is Arabic. 2 years ago, the White House launched something called the National Security Language Initiative. The idea was to give more Americans a chance to learn Arabic, as well as Farsi, Russian, Chinese, and Hindi. It's a bit of a drop in the bucket, but I guess you've got to start somewhere. It turns out that Arabic language schools in some parts of the Middle East have actually been popular for several years, predating this Bush administration initiative. They're popular especially in Egypt. Here's a report from Ursula Lindsay in Cairo.
Arabic language programs here are packed.
We're getting more and more people applying.
Zainab Taha heads the Arabic Language Institute at the American University in Cairo.
The problem is that we cannot accommodate more because the number of classrooms, the physical space here is restricted.
Most of these aspiring Arabists are Americans. Some are Middle East studies majors doing their junior year abroad. Others are studying Arabic because they hope to become diplomats or journalists or work in the oil and gas industry. Blake Hounshell came here from Pittsburgh to pursue a career in academia.
September 11th obviously brought a lot more focus on this region. I hadn't actually known much about it before September 11th, other than, you know, following the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And I figured that, you know, the first thing you have to do in order to understand a place is speak the language.
Several new language schools have popped up around Cairo to satisfy the growing demand for Arabic. Ben Dowd came from Georgia to study at a school here. Dowd is trying to build on his experience.
When I was in the States, I taught world religions at a private school. You know, I could see myself continuing that, or maybe someday I can see myself teaching at a university or having a job where they need people to really understand the culture of the Middle East, because I think a lot of people don't.
Most people who come here to learn Arabic enroll at language schools, but some take less conventional routes. Robin Moger took private classes with a tutor and studied alone every night.
I would go and sit in a room, or at night I'd go and sit up on the roof, and I would... slightly bananas, but I would read these texts out loud to myself in the flat for like hours at a time until I finished them. And then I'd list vocabulary and I'd go through that.
Mojer also practices Arabic with the other customers at a local coffee shop.
I used to sit with them a lot and that really helped. That was fascinating. They used to tell me a lot of stuff, a lot of phrases and sort of proverbs and lots of sort of more traditional stuff and like country songs, and I used them. Brazenly, I would go down and sort of sip tea and just so I could learn from them. But it paid off, I think.
No matter how students learn Arabic, they almost all agree it's a hard language to master. Arabic Arabic students must learn a new alphabet and learn to read from right to left. The grammar and vocabulary are completely different from those of Western languages. Arabic students also have to do double work. They must learn modern standard Arabic, which is used in the media, in literature, and in public speaking. But they also have to learn colloquial Arabic. Arabic teacher Adel Abdelmonem says standard Arabic and local dialects, such as Egypt's Amea, have distinct vocabularies.
In modern standard Arabic, if you want bread, I will say أريد خبزا. While in Amea, you will say أنا عايز عيش. That's totally different.
Arabic may be a difficult language, but Uncle Sam wants you to learn it. Catherine Jazinka is a State Department diplomat in Cairo. She's in her second year of studying Arabic.
Arabic is a real target language in the department now. It's obviously a critically important language for us.
Only a handful of U.S. officials speak Arabic fluently. Jazinka says more diplomats who know Arabic would help avoid mutual misunderstanding. Arabic teacher Abdelmonem expresses a similar sentiment.
I'm just hoping that more students who are studying Arabic now will contribute to more tolerance and more understanding, not only for the Arab culture, but at least for both cultures. Whether this is will be or not, that I don't know. Because you're still faced with lots of people with clichés and misunderstanding and misconception. Which I think it's the nature of human being. Huh?
The students in this classroom have different reasons for being here, but they have a common goal: to speak Arabic as if they've been speaking it all their lives. For The World, I'm Ursula Lindsay in Cairo.
We recently found another American who's learning Arabic. Turns out that Arabic is among several languages she's currently dabbling in. Her name is Elizabeth Little, and she is besotted with just about any language she comes across. She's formerly studied five languages: French, Italian, Chinese, her favorite, also classical Chinese and ancient Greek. She also has a fascination with languages spoken by very few people, not necessarily useful to learn, like English or Arabic, but just as rich. All of this has found its way into a book, which is called Biting the Wax Tadpole, Confessions of a Language Fanatic. Here's Elizabeth Little in conversation with The World's Lisa Mullins.
I don't think many people have an image in their head of what they think a big language fanatic would be. And certainly I seem very normal on the outside.
Yeah.
I'm a huge baseball fan. I love TV.
You watch Jon Stewart.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. All of those things. And so when I sort of slip something into the conversation about, oh, I read this thing about this Amazonian language, there's always this pause where people sort of reconsider
and
recompute.
Do you say this like on the first date?
Oh, gosh, all the time. It's terrible.
You do. You let it out that quickly.
I do. Well, there are only so many things I can talk about. And it turns out that it's either Buffy the Vampire Slayer or weird language quirks. So.
Let me guess which one attracts a better conversation. All right. Well, tell us where this penchant began for you.
Well, it began for me actually when I was very young. My father's Canadian, and so he thought it would be a really good thing to start teaching me French when I was little, mostly because he loved the idea of being able to parade me to his other Canadian family members and saying, well, she can't ski, but she can speak French, so she is one of us. And I just loved deciphering it. I loved the mystery of language, the fact that it was this little code that I could work on cracking. And also, I had Nancy Drew books in French, which is a marvelous way to get kids interested.
Absolutely. Yeah. Do they translate as George and Bess?
They do. They do, actually. Although I've discovered, you know, I have read the Harry Potter books in a few languages, and they always change the names in other languages. And I was trying to figure out why they would do that if, you know, Dumbledore sounds really obscene in Italian or something like that.
All right. So let's bring in another culture, specifically a song, the Mexican Hat Dance.
Ah, yes.
Where does that fit in?
The first time I ever studied Latin was actually in my elementary school, which I think is probably pretty unusual, but I went to a very sort of hippie alternative school. And they taught us how to conjugate the verb amare in Latin, which means to love. And we sang it to the Mexican hat dance.
And? How does that sound?
And it goes something like, amo amas amant, amamis amantis amant. And
keep going.
That's it. It's just the six basic conjugations. And you can use that with pretty much any Latin verb or French verbs or Italian verbs. And so that actually has become my go-to mnemonic device when learning conjugations. If you just use that tone, you find that you can really memorize things very well.
Seriously, so that still helps you now?
It does, it does.
Okay, so when there are so few people who might speak a particular language, or the language is maybe a dying language that people like you, thankfully, are keeping alive, what's the reward that you get?
Well, language is just the repository of everything about a culture, about its history, the personality of its people, the sense of humor that's sort of been developed over the years. And whenever you really start studying a language and understanding how it works, you understand something really important about other cultures and other people.
Like what, though? I mean, what, give me an example of what you've learned that you wouldn't have learned if you didn't know the language.
Well, for instance, there are many languages in Australia, a language in particular called Gerbil, which is not spelled like the rodent, but...
How is it spelled?
D-Y-I-R-B-A-L. And Gerbil has an extra language that unfortunately has sort of fallen out of use, but it has sort of two dialects within the language, one that you use, and it's called an avoidance language, and you use with particular family members.
An avoidance language.
Yeah, it's sort of like if you're trying to be extra, extra, extra polite, or people that there are sort of cultural taboos against speaking to directly. And, you know, sort of if you're talking to your friend's little sister or something to make sure that she's not offended by anything you would say. And so there's actually a new vocabulary that Gerbil speakers can use when talking to these family members. And the most important person who is addressed in avoidance languages is actually one's mother-in-law. So it's referred to throughout linguistic literature actually as mother-in-law languages.
And is there a favorite that you have of all the languages that you've studied?
Well, my sentimental favorite is Chinese. But one of my most favorite languages these days is something called Pidahan, which has caused a huge uproar in the linguistics community. It's a very small has a very small group of speakers in the Amazon, and it is very unusual in basically every way. There is humming and singing and whistling incorporated into the language. There are numbers don't really exist in the language. Fixed color terms don't really exist. And so it's really fascinating because it appears to possibly, if not bend, then almost break some of the rules that linguists have thought all languages follow.
Now, that's very interesting, Elizabeth, because that, I think, is part of the allure for you, whereas for many people, that would be the point where we would shut the textbook and say, I give up.
Exactly.
You know, is this really worth it? But how come it's worth it for you?
Well, I think that what language really shows for me is this infinite capacity of the human brain to come up with so many different ways of expressing a single thought. And my whole life is about expressing thoughts in new and interesting ways. And so to come across these languages that have come up with things that I would never in a million years think of is really inspiring, I have to say. Mm-hmm. And also, obviously, quite challenging because these are things that I would never be able to master. And I love that there are things out there that would be probably impossible in my lifetime to master. It's good to know that there's a challenge.
Is there another frontier for you now, linguistically? Where are you going next?
Well, I continue to be very fond of, you know, working on languages in my spare time. I'm traveling to Hungary in a week.
Oh.
So I've been making a few futile efforts to get some Hungarian under my belt, and I'm failing miserably. It's going to be hugely embarrassing when I get there. But also what I'm interested now in is looking at techniques of language learning and how the ways that I've studied languages and that men and women have studied language throughout history can really help on a practical level. Because the question I always get when I tell people about my hobby is, how do I learn a language? How can I overcome that hurdle of embarrassment and thinking that I'm not bright enough to learn a language?
What do you say?
Well, I say that everyone can. If you know one language, you can learn another language. And the trick really is to find the system that works best for you, not to feel constrained to stick with your high school Spanish textbook or, you know, those CDs of Spanish in your car. If those don't work for you, there are always other options.
Like what?
Well, my favorite way to learn languages is to read books, read my favorite books, and watch my favorite TV shows in translation.
Such as what?
Primarily with Spanish recently. I've been watching a lot of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is...
In Spanish,
which is Buffy la Casa Vampiros. And what you can do is because on DVDs, most have Spanish language tracks now.
Isn't it just frustrating, though, if you don't know the language?
Well, it is frustrating if you're speaking it, for sure, because when you start off, you're always speaking at a sort of child's level of language. And that's frustrating for any grown person because you work so hard to get out of childhood and suddenly you're just thrown right back in. But if you're watching something or reading something that you really love and that you're really familiar with, I find that it's actually incredibly gripping to work out between your brain, you know, what you know so well. So I will watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer or read Pride and Prejudice or Roald Dahl or something like that. And to really see how it fits back and forth is really rewarding.
I find also the less ego you have as you're speaking a language,
absolutely,
you're trying it out, the better. It's, those people who just kind of push forward and say, okay, if I make a silly mistake and somebody laughs.
The most important thing imaginable is to not worry about getting it perfect because you're never, ever going to get it perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, even in our native language, we say things wrong all the time.
By the way, I should say that in your book you include a list of a word survival list, so you don't get.
Yeah, whenever I travel somewhere, I make up the sort of most important things that I need to know. For instance, you know, when traveling to China, I was aware that it would probably be a good thing if I knew words to turn down marriage proposals, which turned out to be important because I was always approached by women who thought it would be wonderful if their son married a very, very tall woman.
Isn't that interesting?
And everywhere I went, the first thing that people would always say to me was, "Namagao," which just means so big, like, how tall are you?
So how did you, what's the good way to turn down, the polite way to turn down a marriage
proposal?
Well,
I usually said something very nice like, oh, I'm sure your son is lovely, but, you know, I have a boyfriend. So that was the most important thing to learn was how to say I have a boyfriend.
And what else? Are there any words that you try to stay away from that you might slip into?
Well, there are some words in Chinese where the words are sort of everyday sounds, but if you use the wrong tone, it could be something very rude indeed. So I tried to steer clear of those words altogether. So, for instance, there's a word that can mean grass or grass thatch roof or something like that. But spoken with the wrong tone, it means something very, very offensive. A number of times, there were sort of interesting attitudes about what a Western woman might be doing by herself traveling in these sort of hotels.
And sure.
I was always going from hotel to hotel to hotel because I was a travel writer. And so I was reviewing these hotels. And there were certainly a number of skeptical glances that were shot my way, being like, well, why do you need to know how much a room costs and, you know, how much it costs to get a king-sized bed? So when I came back, I realized that if ever I were to travel alone for hotel researching purposes, that would probably be a list I would want to be prepared.
Right. You have an interesting list. Maybe you can give us a couple of examples in the list as to why people – unusual reasons why people should learn languages.
Right. Well, the usual reasons we hear are things like, oh, it'll help you in international business, or it's, you know, obviously important for the government to have people who know many languages to help with politics and diplomacy. But I think that really misses out on all of the great fun things that there are to be had. And so that's why I thought about less publicized reasons for learning a language, things like having actual rewarding conversations with your long-distance tech support. Mm-hmm. You know, how many people have had frustrating arguments about their Dell computers or whatnot. Well, here you can actually sort of charm them over to your side. I find that in Scrabble, foreign words are very useful, particularly for your Q and not U words. Many Arabic words have QA in their transliterations, so you can, you know, wow all of your friends when you're playing Scrabble. You know, Japanese game shows and Spanish telenovelas and Eastern European reality shows, all of these things are things that you can really dig into if you know another language.
There's one more on the list.
And, of course, the most important is if you are the sort to go and get a tattoo, making sure that your Chinese tattoo does not, in fact, say something like crazy diarrhea, which is actually a documented tattoo that someone has gotten.
An American,
exactly. There are whole lists of Chinese tattoos that people have gotten, and their tattoo artists haven't spoken, you know, really didn't understand how the characters worked, or they used an online translator, and they go to get something like, you know, I love Genie forever, and they end up getting something like, you know, French fries are wonderful with avocado. So...
Elizabeth Little, author of Biting the Wax Tadpole, a really fun read. And I must say, it made me wonder why my college linguistics professor couldn't write that way, too. The expression biting the wax tadpole, by the way, is one of those literal translations that must have seemed like a good idea at the time. We'll explain where it came from in a future podcast that we're going to devote to the Chinese language. That'll be in a few weeks. Okay, finally today we go down market. I mean really, really far down to the depths of the annual Eurovision Song Contest. You know, the Eurovision is one of those stories that we feature on The World, the broadcast version of The World, maybe, I think at least, a little too much. At editorial meetings, I'm often the lone voice, in fact, arguing against it. Why? Well, most of our listeners are from the US and they've never heard of this competition. But then my colleagues argue back at me, maybe it's something people would like to hear about. So now I'm following my colleagues' advice and we're going to do the Eurovision. But here's a warning. If you've gone through life blissfully ignorant of the Eurovision Song Contest, prepare now for an experience with such a high cheese factor that Velveeta wouldn't do it justice. Okay, we've done the warning. You're still listening. Here goes. Each year, the countries of Europe pick musicians to represent them in a televised competition. And you and I are just like they. Okay, some of you who recognize that song may be saying, but this is Donny and Marie Osmond. What does Utah's most famous singing couple have to do with a European competition? Well, I'm trying to orient you culturally. If the US were part of the Eurovision, the Osmonds would, without a question of doubt, they would have won the competition. In fact, winning the Eurovision would have been their big break. It was ABBA's big break. Their song Waterloo won in 1974, and as we all know, the rest is Swedish musical history. Now, ABBA is the cultural pinnacle, the champagne of Eurovision's vision. No one nearly as classy has ever won the Eurovision, probably not even entered the competition. Certainly not Finnish band Lordi with their toe-tapping anthem Hard Rock Hallelujah, which was victorious 2 years ago. Not an act called Teach-In from the Netherlands, which won in 1975 with the classic lyric Ding a Dong. When you're feeling all right, everything is uptight, try to sing a song that goes ding, ding a dong. There will be no sorrow when you sing tomorrow and you walk along with your ding, ding, dong. Now, just imagine what some of the losers sound like. Well, actually, you don't have to imagine, because this past weekend, this year's competition took place in Belgrade, and the entry from Belgium did not win. Russia did. But the Belgian song made its own news. Here's The World's Alex Galifant.
The song in question is called O Ulysse. Don't ask me what it means, because it doesn't mean anything. Recently, composer Michel Van Hielwe played it through for a reporter. Well, that's it. Turns out the lyrics are in an invented language, and this invented language isn't very easy to remember.
That's good. The composer doesn't know the words.
Luckily, Van Hielwe wasn't singing O Ulysse in the Eurovision Song Contest. That job fell to a professional mezzo-soprano accompanied by Van Hielwe's band, Ishtar. Van Hielwe says O Ulysse is meant to capture
the happiness and the joy of a child who doesn't have to think about life.
Presumably, that child doesn't have to think about being understood either. Some wondered if the made-up language of O Ulysse could help bridge the gap between Belgium's actual languages, the countries divided along language lines. Most people speak either French or Dutch, referred to as Flemish. But that wasn't on Michel Van Hielwe's mind when he wrote the thing.
I didn't think about this. It could be a symbol for bringing people together. I mean, language nowadays can be a political issue, but it shouldn't.
By the way, Ishtar's not the first musical outfit to experiment with invented languages. Go back to 1946 and you'll find the vocalese of jazz musician Slim Gaylord, a style of speech called Vaut O'Rini.
Here's a Vaut O'Rini number title, Laguna O'Rini Macbooty Scoodly Rooty O'Riti.
Vaut O'Rini.
Ruto.
Scoot.
Laguna O'Rini. Laguna O'Rini. Laguna O'Rini.
A great deal of fun, if you ask me. Maybe that's why contemporary composers are still drawn to making up their own languages. Welsh composer Carl Jenkins has gone whole hog with his Adiemus series. Jenkins says he wants to reflect the sounds of languages from all over the globe. For the world, I'm Alex Galifant.
Stop! Stop, please! Even those Eurovision songs sound bearable next to that.
One last Eurovision note. The song from France was sung in English, and that didn't go down well with some French people, including this Member of Parliament, Jacques Millard.
I tell you, I'm rather shocked by this song in English, not because we should not speak English, it's a main language in world politics, but we are in a Euro contest, and every nation should, let's say, sell its own culture and not trying to monkey this other's culture. And this is the first time that the choice has been so stupid.
You and I, it's like you said, another Jeeves anywhere, but you do fine.
Okay, that's it for this edition of The World in Words. Next week, we're going to Arizona. Yes, I know I promised that last week, and you got Eurovision instead. Well, we really will go to Arizona next week to check in with the language wars there.
So try to find the Milky Way. Set off to drink it every day.
I'm Patrick Cox. Go to our website at theworld.org for more. Also, send me your comments. The address is language@pri.org. Also, there's now a Facebook group called The World in Words. So if you're on Facebook, please check that out. Till next time, adieu.
I'm alone in life to say. I'm not a Jeeves anywhere. Jeeves to try to find the Milky Way.